pronated us so that trying to take out the garbage is difficult. So
we've had a request that we all speak louder.
Yes. Okay.
Because someone who listens to us remotely would like to.
That'd have to be Ken.
Oh, really?
Hear better.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
That would have to be Ken.
Am right. I going to? Well, no, somebody else, isn't it?
Really?
I thought it was somebody else. Anyway, really? Please speak up because
Ken Crosby.
Yeah, the recording.
Oh, is it from Ken?
Isn't it? Yes, but he hears these.
The mic is here, and this is all we're going to get.
Well, he's not going to red light my boarding pass, is he?
Red light?
Yeah, I got red lighted trying to get back here.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
From where? Barcelona?
Yeah, going through Atlanta.
Well, that was probably the mistake, choosing an American airport.
Well, I know. We moved there in 89 when it was a small airport, easy in and out, not anymore. So anyway, that was a problem. So one of the things that I had wanted to start off with was a quote by, let's introduce ourselves again, okay? And would you start and say anything you want besides your name?
I have nothing to say at the moment, thank you.
What's your name?
My name?
Yeah.
I thought about it, you're my name, Ron Napier.
Okay.
I'm a founding member of this organization.
Yes, I know.
Hi, I'm Cy Seifert. I just finally moved down here permanently.
Did you say Cy?
Cy. Yeah.
Cy.
Okay.
Yeah, with a Cy.
Steven Siegel. I wasn't here from the beginning, but close.
Uh-huh.
Leslie Edwards. I'm here just supporting my mom.
Lloyd Cumley.
I'm sorry?
Lloyd Cumley.
Lloyd. Uh-huh.
Henry Laxson.
And I'm Valerie Edwards.
Lou Raskin.
Okay, yeah. So I was going to start out with a comment by H.L. Mencken, which says, "We must respect the other fellow's religion, but only in the sense and to the extent that we respect his theory that his wife is beautiful and his children smart." So that's where we are. And I wanted to also hand out to you the statement of principles for the affirmation of humanism. Okay.
Thank you.
And one more for Leslie. Oh, Leslie. Okay, everybody. Okay. So there was a lot of talk in the last umpteen sessions about humanism, and especially last time when some people didn't know about Paul Kurtz and the affirmation of humanism. And so that's why I thought it would be a good time, and I know Stephen is pretty well versed in humanism too. Henry, you're also.
No, not really.
No?
Nope.
So about Paul Kurtz, was that he was the one who founded these principles of humanism. And he was a big fan of Bertrand Russell, my hero, who also I consider Bertrand Russell being an atheist, but really a humanist. And I see no difference between atheism, agnosticism, spiritualism, and whatever with humanism. So, he was a graduate in New York, and he's kind of the founding father of these principles of what makes up humanism. So, he graduated with a degree besides PhD in the arts and science, because he saw the integration of art and science. And I certainly do agree with that. So if we quickly read down the statement of principles, because I want you to think outside the United States about what other countries might hold many of these ideals, or some of them. So we are committed to the application of reason and science to the understanding of the universe and to the solving of human problems. We deplore efforts to denigrate human intelligence to seek to explain the world in supernatural terms and to look outside nature for salvation. We believe that scientific discovery and technology can contribute to the betterment of human life. I want you to think as we're reading these about countries. We believe in an open and pluralistic society, and that democracy is the best guarantee of protecting human rights from authoritarian elites and repressive majorities. We are committed to the principle of the separation of church and state. We cultivate the arts of negotiation and compromise as a means of resolving differences and achieving mutual understanding. We are concerned with securing justice and fairness in society and with eliminating discrimination and intolerance. We believe in supporting the disadvantaged and the handicapped so that they will be able to help themselves. We attempt to transcend divisive parochial loyalties based on race, religion, gender, nationality, creed, class, sexual orientation, or ethnicity, and strive to work together for the common good of humanity. We want to protect and enhance the earth, to preserve it for future generations, and to avoid inflicting needless suffering on other species. We believe in enjoying life here and now and in developing our creative talents to their fullest. We have said that remark, I think, two times ago when we met. We believe in the cultivation of moral excellence. We respect the right to privacy. Mature adults should be allowed to fulfill their aspirations, to express their sexual preferences, to exercise reproductive freedom, to have access to comprehensive and informed health care, and to die with dignity. We believe in the common moral decency, altruism, integrity, honesty, truthfulness, responsibility. Humanist ethics is amenable to critical, rational guidance. There are normative standards that we discuss together. Moral principles are tested by their consequences. We are deeply concerned with the moral education of our children. We want to nourish reason and compassion. We are engaged by the arts no less than by the sciences. I want you to remember that one. We are citizens of the universe and are excited by discoveries still to be made in the cosmos. We are skeptical of untested claims to knowledge, and we are open to novel ideas and seek new departures in our thinking. It's another one I want you to remember. We affirm humanism as a realistic alternative to theologies of despair and ideologies of violence, and as a source of rich personal significance and genuine satisfaction to the service of others.
Close the door.
We believe in optimism rather than pessimism. That's hard for me. Hope rather than despair. Again, hard for me. Learning in the place of dogma, truth instead of ignorance, joy rather than guilt or sin, tolerance in the place of fear, love instead of hatred, compassion over selfishness, beauty instead of ugliness. I want you to remember that part, and reason rather than blind faith or irrationality. We believe in the fullest realization of the best and noblest that we are capable of as human beings. Now you know why I don't want us to discuss the United States. But I want you to just think about other countries in your head that might have some of these principles, or possibly all of them, which I don't think so. So, but I do want to read quickly. Have any of you been to Bhutan?
No.
No?
Been to where?
Bhutan.
But I read
about
it.
Yeah, Bhutan, okay. Well, for me, I went to Bhutan in 2013 to study their government policy of gross national happiness. You're only allowed to stay in Bhutan for 2 weeks. And so it's a closed country, 700,000 people, about that. Buddhism of two types of Buddhism, one road coming in from India, and closed off to other countries. So I'm quickly going to read to you something about Bhutan, because it is recognized by the United Nations as one day in service to an praise to their government policy. Bhutan is a mystical kingdom, trouble-free and blissful, lies in the imagination of the West. Dori Penhor says, Penhor is an anthropologist who has been researching Bhutan's biggest soft power export, gross national happiness. He says GNH is an attempt to live in a way that's holistic, not restricted to merely measuring economics like the gross domestic product or GDP. When Bhutan's prime minister introduced GNH to a United Nations forum as a paradigm for alternative development in 1998, it turned heads and spawned a global industry in happiness. Think tanks dissected it, and governments grappling with improving social policies took a serious look. After the 2008 financial crisis, Penhor says, people started to question the viability of Western liberal capitalism, the corporate world, and we were bombarded with questions. Today, experts and dignitaries attend World Happiness Summits. The UN has declared a World Happiness Day. Students enrolled in happiness courses. Yale reported in the most popular class ever this year, How to Live a Happy Life. And this past week, the Delhi school system announced it is adding happiness to its curriculum, citing Bhutan. That's Yale. Yet when the United Nations released a report ranking countries by happiness last year, Bhutan was nowhere near the top. Norway took the crown. So I want you to keep thinking in your head about these other countries. The U.S. ranked 14th. Beautiful Bhutan came
14th 90th. 14th in what, happiness?
Yeah.
And how is happiness
No idea. Okay. Beautiful Bhutan came 97th. So I dispute. Still, the landlocked South Asian kingdom intends to keep a close measure of the public mood, and it's famous for it. Dividing gross national happiness is a matter of minutely categorizing and carefully tracking the lives of Bhutan's 800,000 citizens. So it's gained 100,000 since I've been there. Every 5 years, under the direction of the Center for Bhutan Studies and GNH Research, survey takers fan out across the country to conduct questionnaires of some 8,000 randomly selected households. That's not quite true. The complex survey is broken down into 9 domains, 33 indicators, and hundreds more variables. The broad categories include psychological well-being, health, time use, education, culture, good governance, community vitality, ecology, and living standards. This is no Western-style satisfaction survey on a scale from 0 to 10, Behor says. Bhutan asks about 300 questions in each household. In the beginning, the survey took about 9 hours, he says. Now we have refined the questions. It takes about 3 hours. Happily, the participants are compensated a day's wage. At one of the center's lead Happy Index researchers, Behor says, we try to measure all forms of capital. So that is the difference between GDP and GNH. Bhutan is facing climate change, with melting glaciers potentially affecting the hydropower plants that provide the nation's energy and a big chunk of its revenue, all of it. We have a lot of things to worry about. Radio host Zam says the idea of GNH may have put Bhutan on the map, but the concept has been hijacked by the West and quantified to a degree that makes it unrecognizable to ordinary Bhutanese. Gross national happiness is rooted in the principles of the country's religion, Buddhism, with its focus on compassion, contentment, and calmness. And Zam insists you don't quantify Buddhism. Yet, she says, she has an abiding belief in the philosophy underlying GNH, if not the packaging. The title of the last Bhutan Gross National Happiness Survey in 2015 sums up what the country believes its experiment can provide, a compass toward a just and harmonious society. The findings show that 8% of the people were deeply happy, 35% identified as extremely happy, and 47.9% registered as narrowly happy. So I I was fascinated by Bhutan, and I don't know if some of you saw Anthony Bourdain's last piece on television, Parts Unknown. You know, he committed suicide right after going to Bhutan. But I watched him very carefully. And one of the things that I saw in Bhutan also was a deep division between secularism and Buddhism. And I believe this man who was Buddhist and Bhutanese said to Anthony Bourdain that, ask about Buddhism, is no, every day you should wake up and think, what can I do that is good today? Forget about the religion. And I found that very true in Bhutan. So I, you know, kind of was fascinated, having lived in a lot of countries, visited a lot of countries, projects in other countries, that Bhutan had this idea of, in the sciences, from the elementary school level, I sat in a fifth grade class, they teach the sciences. And that is to, they were doing water filtration systems. And they closed the country in 1972 because they do have a monarchy, but it's aside. And they're very beautiful people. But, the king saw that consumerism was devouring the world. And that's why they decided on this program to close Bhutan and carefully regulate things without indoctrination of the students into Buddhism, or but mostly into showing that Bhutan could be a country that would be a symbol for the rest of the world how to retain your environment. So you can't take the fish out of the river. You can't. A lot of interesting things. The women all inherit property, the house. So if the man leaves, that gender is an interesting concept there too. So anyway, so I wanted to start off the conversation with, well, one other thing. While I was there, I understood there was two countries interested in implementing some types of program, and that was Brazil and France. I was surprised about France, not surprised about Brazil, because Brazil has a large area of smaller villages where you could implement that, especially south of Brazil with the plantas, you know. So anyway, does anyone have any kind of ideas about the possibilities of other countries that we've seen or know?
Well, I have a question about why a discussion on the affirmations of humanism is about Bhutan.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I did mark that.
So the bees are Bhutan.
Yeah, right. But one of the things was I was interested in what they were doing. We were engaged by the arts no less than the sciences. So what Bhutan is doing is trying, they do have art schools where the students come and they are put up in dorms and whatnot, but they are only allowed to practice and define the arts of the ancient culture of Bhutan.
But could you explain, please, why a discussion on the affirmations of humanism is about Bhutan now?
Well, because I saw so many things are that such as that we're engaged by the arts no less than by the sciences, and that was true.
Yes. Right there is.
I saw that. I saw they're integrating the idea of the arts of Bhutan, the old cultural arts, besides the sciences, which were taught specifically in the elementary school level. And then the arts started later of them trying to hold on to their cultural art history. And then the other thing was
still don't understand.
Yeah.
I still don't understand why a discussion that was advertised as being about the affirmations of humanism is now about Bhutan.
Well, because I found while I was there that, having lived in a lot of other countries, that it so emulated so many of the passions that I have as preserving the earth, teaching the sciences, understanding, careful about consumerism, such as they allowed television in and they allowed the wrestling channel in. And what they found was all of a sudden boys started fighting, so they took off the wrestling channel. So they're, what I found was they're trying to carefully not impact the environment or consumerism. A certain amount of cars, keeping control of the footprint on the earth. And so all of that I saw as humanistic. Their attitude or separation of church and state was very, very clear. When you go into an area with a big Buddhist temple and then right across the terrace or the patio was the other government building that said secular. And there was a tremendous amount of secularism in all the people that I was dealing with.
So the topic today is the ways in which Bhutan represents the affirmations of humanism.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
That might have, well, that should, probably should have appeared in the announcement.
But I understood you to say that we should think about other countries. And so I'm not familiar with Bhutan, but what you say sounds like a really nice place. And I see in your discussion and these principles are reflected in what they're trying to do there and what apparently exists.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like there's a number of other countries, and I think of Europe, many of the European countries and Scandinavian countries in particular, that are way beyond what I experienced in the United States generally.
Well, that's very true. That's why I left out of the United States.
Yeah, right. So my response to what other countries is that Holland, for example, and most of the Scandinavian countries fit many, many, many of these things. And Europe is moving that way rapidly and may already be humanist in many ways.
I agree with that, except that the thing about Bhutan is you can't live there. You can't stay there. You can only stay for two weeks. And they're trying to create kind of a symbol for what the possibilities are. Because I agree with you that we lived in Europe, in several countries, and had health care and free education, things like that. But I did see that in Bhutan and Asia, that Eastern thought is so different than Western thought, that you felt kind of the difference, that there was more kind of pride in maintaining the earth, such as they don't enforce veganism because of the older people. They're not oppressive. But they only allow a market from India to come in once a week into their capital, Thimphu. It says the India market, so that people can buy meat and whatnot. But the other part of the market is all vegetarian. Yes?
Why do you think it was ranked so low in the... I mean, I saw that study, and I don't know where it was. But, you know, with all of that you perceived and that they think about, and yet they were 96th. Is that correct on the list? Or 94th?
Do you believe the polls?
Well, I know, and I understand. I mean, that's the reason I ask. I think potentially it could be... I don't know, Pavlov's dog or whatever, but potentially it could be because it's a closed country, so it wasn't, you know, a lot of people weren't voting for it, didn't get voted for, you know, it was all that, you know, good aspects of it, you know.
I think you're right, because it's closed, and that would be one of the things that she mentioned as a determining factor, would be very low in that area.
It's a bicameral democratic government.
Right.
Uh-huh, and they're certainly involved as I went to and saw several rallies and things. Finn, who was our Bhutanese guide, was 34 and kind of marvelous. And his desire, like a lot of others, wanted to go to the United States. And he got to Virginia and went to a university, graduated,
right.
And then went to Seattle and worked for an environmental company. And so Finn said, he worked for 7 years and lived in the United States for 7 years. And he said, I wanted always to leave Bhutan. But when I came home, it was the first time I ever felt hope.
Felt hope?
Hope, that's what he said. The first time he ever felt hope. He was an amazing
young man. Do you know what that means?
Yes, because he was in a country, back in his country, where he realized that his country was doing the kind of things that he, environmentally, because he graduated with environmental degrees, that he felt hope. I don't think any of us today feel hope.
I do.
You do? I know, Stephen.
Yeah, why not? I have a great life.
You didn't watch the TV.
I have a great life, mm-hmm. Don't you?
Sure.
We're of course, a select group down here and also retired and well-to-do, probably compared to most of the world. Mm-hmm. I was intrigued with your idea, and I hadn't thought about it until recently, I mean, for a while. But Buddhism really is a humanistic...
Is a humanist.
Humanistic philosophy of life. There's mm-hmm. no supernatural, as far as right. I know, though it's kind of transmogrified into a little bit of a supernatural because the Buddha is seen as a godlike to some people, but humanism and Buddhism are of the same approach, mostly.
Yes, because I've always said, there's a good movie called Hell in the Pacific.
Called what?
Hell in the Pacific, bad name, but it's Hell, with Lee Marvin, and Japan's most famous movie actor, Akira. I'll remember at the moment. But it's during the Second World War, and they find themselves on an island isolated, and they run into each other.
Thank you.
They don't know the war's over. And I use that movie as to show what I was always questioning. What's the difference? Why should the twain never meet? Why can the Eastern world never meet the Western world? And the difference is that in a crisis situation, like they found themselves on an island, the Western man goes outside himself and says, oh, God, help me for anything, you know. The Eastern man goes inside himself to find his inner security. And I do think that the young men, the 12 young boys in the cave in Thailand, that they were very lucky to have a coach who is Buddhist and kept them calm through meditation, inner self.
Yeah, I read that. That was wonderful.
Yes.
I know, man. That was a good thing for them.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it made them all calm. And they're going, you know, none of them swim. They have to teach them kind of how to swim to get out of there.
Yeah.
So, okay, I'm sorry.
No.
But Buddhism is more of a philosophy, as you talked about.
Exactly.
It's thought of to be a religion, but...
Yeah.
It's a way of life.
It's a way of life. It's a philosophy.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yes. So I didn't. I've been in other Buddhist countries, but in Bhutan, I think what struck me so much was that as Buddhism and Christianity and other things go out from the center of the world, that religions tend to give you something material to hold on to.
Religions.
Buddhism, Christianity.
Gives you something material to hold on to?
Yeah, like a rosary.
Okay.
Or something, you know.
It's got to be very helpful.
Well, a begging bowl is...
Yeah.
But that's useful.
But I thought that what I saw, having lived in Japan and in China and Thailand and... that Bhutan struck me with the temples that it's also childlike. It's like a carnival when you go inside any of the temples with butter animals, everything made out of butter and kinds of things in the houses. It's not a, I would say that, there's cars and things, but the level of living is, I think, up to above poverty, but not to the high level.
But not what?
Not to the highest level, you know, okay. Class, you know, that we have in other countries, including Europe. That's why I found Bhutan interesting, was that the levels seem to be, you know, kind of like this, middle level and a couple below. But I did.
Not as much of a gap.
Yeah, it was not the exactly. Yes, absolutely not. No, absolutely not. Not.
So I do have another question. Mm-hmm. So you saw Brazil and France, and you were surprised at France. Why?
Well, we lived in France. I don't know where in France that they could have a group of people to be able to put in these programs. Unlike when Napoleon came in the 1800s and instituted education and things like that. That's not France. But in Brazil, they have large, large areas of small villages and tribes and stuff that they could institute. Not in Sao Paulo, not in Rio,
right.
But in other areas of Brazil. It's a possibility. So there's other South American countries that are a possibility. My boy.
No, I have something that disturbs me about Bhutan, and it's disturbed me for a long time now.
Mm-hmm.
I think about the television, and my understanding is until fairly recently, television was illegal, but you couldn't have it. I don't know when they quit. Then they let it in, and then you say now they're clamping down on which programs can be shown.
Well, they, yeah.
Right.
I would like to clamp down on some of them too.
So, now I think that, you know, particularly the advertising media create a lot of suffering, a lot of unhappiness because it creates mm-hmm. want.
Yes.
But how does that balance with freedom of speech? You know, this.
I didn't see any oppression in some of the areas we went to where they were having somebody coming out running for a candidate or things like that. And Finn, who was our guide, and was going to run for a government position within 2 years. And from what my understanding, he was extraordinarily intelligent, that they didn't have that kind of a president. Everybody seemed to be involved, which fascinated me. That now, I can't tell you, I don't want to be the expert on Bhutan. I just had the expertise of an experience and being who I am, getting involved, asking questions, being there, that what I observed, having been in other countries and studying other countries.
Yeah, no, part of my take, you know, was like the second law of the Buddha was that suffering arises from want. You want things to be other than they are, uh-huh. and you want this and you want that. So I've always thought that the synthetic creation of want then has to be something not good, which would be American advertising. You know, like, you haven't made it if you don't have this car. Mm-hmm. I mean, that to me, that creates suffering. But then again, is it a right to have for Ford Motor Company to make this advertising? You know, like, even though they do create an undesirable result,
mm-hmm.
for them desirable, they buy jet fuel for the private jets, etc. So I don't know, that's bothered me about the Bhutan. You know, I've always held it in some awe, you know, mm-hmm. that they had this peace or happiness and they would do things like discuss death a lot, and you know, they're not afraid to bring it up have it part of their culture.
Yes, because they believe in reincarnation.
Yeah, not sure I do, and I'm not sure the Buddha did either, but the Buddha was somewhat Hindu. So I don't know, I just always wondered about that. I mean, I'm not really even making a statement other than it bothers me, you know.
Well, it certainly doesn't fit in with the principles.
We haven't talked about this since you read them.
Yeah.
We're only talking about Buddhism and Bhutan.
Yeah.
What's that have to do with this?
Well, because as I was trying to use an example by going through this, that to kind of use Bhutan and then push it over into other countries. That's what I ask of 195 countries. Which are other countries that have these similar, any of these?
I'd say most of the Western democracies do.
You think so?
I think so, yes.
Yeah?
Do you disagree?
Uh-huh.
Well, say something about that.
I think that Spain, for instance, is having...
I mean, I'm sure you can find examples of countries that don't follow all these lists.
That's right. That's
well, I don't think any country probably follows them all.
No, and I don't think that's even an interesting discussion to have. But I think these principles mostly represent European and American principles and Canadian.
Well, but the point was that the Buddhist...
And Canadian.
And the Buddhist approach seems to be somewhat complementary to these.
It might be, but why would that be important to us?
Well, I'm just saying that the world, this is a statement, I think, Paul Kurtz wants to influence the world. And one of the things that he did during his time when he was alive and running his organization and also involved in the American Humanist Association, he was reaching out to humanists in all the countries of the world that he could find. Uh-huh. And so he was interested in being an international movement.
Exactly.
And so I think that he was, I'm speculating, but I'm suspecting that, based on my understanding of him and his efforts, that he was hoping to have something that would be applicable to all the world and all the peoples in the world.
I'm sure he would.
Yeah. So I think that this certainly would include most of the Buddhist countries as something that they would read the list and say, yes, I agree on that. And they might, you know, like you pointed out, censorship issue, that's a hard one to decide what to do about, because in Bhutan, I don't know whether the children are taught to read and understand advertisements and be intelligent enough to respond to these keywords and these, you know, things that the advertisers raise in you and the wants and the falsities and all that kind of stuff. But
all of them
in the United States, for example, I don't think that we train our children well enough to understand how to deal with advertising.
No, it was interesting to me. Everything's taught in English in Bhutan. Everything's in English. The language I thought was very strange because it sounded to me like Japanese. I can learn this, you know. I thought it was very strange being, you know, that
Japanese?
Japanese,
okay.
It's very syllabic, it's very strange when you find these countries.
I've never thought I could learn Japanese.
Oh, really?
No.
Another one in Hong Kong and Shmoska?
It's
very syllabic. It's very syllabic.
If you writing, you're not going to even pick out the syllables.
We lived in Japan.
What about separation of church and state?
Well, that was really interesting to me. It was very, very, very strong that there was a separation of church and state.
Okay.
And so when you went into an area where they had a Buddhist temple, but they also had a government building, and there was a sign there, secular.
Okay.
And so that the people then, as you were talking about the children, the children... There's not a lot of advertising. They only allow so much cars, trucks to come in because of impact. And then they stop. And they wait until they get to that level. So the children really are not so much, I didn't get hit by the television with lots of advertising or even once. They impress the idea that we're trying to do in the U.S. and other countries is community. And so the communities get together and they all build the same house and they all help in that kind of situation. So the children are really indoctrinated in the school system to work as a team on environmental preservation.
Why did you just include the U.S. in that?
Why did I just include the
U.S.? You mentioned the U.S. and you included, you said like the U.S.
That we were. Trying to, as in the 60s, create.
Okay, that's a long time ago, yeah.
Yeah, and
there's
still.
There's not the U.S. to me anymore.
No, in some places we do. In rural America, we have that. North.
I think it's amazing what has been achieved. You tell us in Bhutan, Bhutan is a country of less than a million people. In
Well, now they said 800,000. They said 700 when I was there, so it's a lot of things going on.
And they don't have problems with different religions and things. They're pretty well all Buddhists.
There's two types of Buddhism that they have, but I didn't see it like I had in Nepal or other countries.
It's hard to imagine any other country being able to follow suit in a way, isn't it?
Uh-huh. Well, interesting that there's a lot of monasteries and a lot of monks, but there did seem to be a strange kind of aura about it that had not experienced in any other area of Asia, having lived there. That's just why I it was for me out of my life experiences.
Well, so. Temples.
Pardon?
It's those yak butter candles stench.
No, like, it was. It's just that I realized. Let's put it this way. Unlike other countries, the Buddhist countries that I've been in, that there was a childlike aspect to any of the temples and whatnot. I always thought Maurice Sendak, you know, Where the Wild Things Are,
right,
had gotten his little fun monsters that were not scary from Asia, but he did not, I found out. I still think it was in his head. Because there is this kind of childlike feeling about Buddhism and in the temples and their festivities and their ogres and their Sendak kind of like ogres, that I thought, since they believe in reincarnation and cyclical life cycles, that it might be going back to that childhood, which we all think in our minds, if you had a day to live over, it's usually a childhood day.
So I consider myself a humanist.
I know you do.
Should I be interested in Buddhism? Or does Buddhism have anything to offer?
No, I think that it's calmness.
Calmness?
Yeah, it's calmness.
Well, I would say the answer is yes, Buddhism has something to offer.
Different from humanism.
Different, but it's part. I mean, I think that Buddhism is an approach, you know, that's a different one, but you kind of get the same place. It's not supernatural. It's more relaxed and calm. I think those of us from the United States are used to a more aggressive and a competitive approach to life. They're a little bit less competitive. I'm speculating. Mm-hmm. You know more about it than I do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I would say, yeah, humanism, Taoism. You know,
Taoism,
I mean, there's a lot. I know a number of humanists in my family who were Taoists.
Yeah.
Can you suggest something that a humanist doesn't know and needs to look outside of humanism to Buddhism or Taoism or something else to find?
I don't think that anything is needed other than humanism. But
okay.
But humanists from the United States would probably not be exposed to some of the things that a humanist Buddhist would be exposed to.
Said humanists and Buddhists as if they were synonyms.
Yeah, they're a similar approach. They're non-theistic and they're interested in human betterment. So I would say that that it's a similar approach.
Okay, so a humanist that understands humanism and has internalized it, would he have a need to go to Buddhism for more?
No.
Okay.
I'm just saying, if you're from the United States and the Western world a little more competitive, the Buddhists would have a different approach, would be a little less competitive and more relaxed and at ease with life going on, and so that might be a better
one.
It might not be. I don't know.
I think something to consider: are both humanism and Buddhism concerned about the cessation of suffering? Because that was the Buddha's concern. He said, when he used to teach, he says, "I only teach two things: suffering and the end of suffering." And you know, his first principle is all existence involves suffering. That was his first statement, which I believe. And, you know, so we constantly deal with it. And so, you know, is humanism involved with the cessation of suffering? If so, then Buddhism is another avenue to explore.
Humanism is involved with the improvement of the human condition, which implies minimalization of suffering.
Okay. Well, the approach, though, in the Eastern world, with Taoism, for instance, is the idea of suffering, but the idea of Taoism is to take it inside yourself, meditate, and spread it. Well, I think the Western world is so harsh on everything, creates the lines in our faces, and that. But with Taoism, it's much more inside meditative kind of thought processes that kind of spreads out the daily problems of suffering. So
this is enough for me.
Yeah, well,
I don't need to go outside of this list.
Well, nobody's asking you to go outside the list.
No, I wouldn't care. But, this is enough for me. I don't really need to go to Bhutan, and I don't need to go to Buddhism. This is
Nobody's asking you to go to Buddhism, but I would. I would.
Some people are born into Buddhism. Some people are born into.
But why is that of interest to us right here, right now? Why are we talking about it?
Because it's the world, and the world is filled with a bunch of different kind of people, and it is my belief, and the reason I got involved in the humanist movement and involved in the AHA and happened to be there while Park Kurtz was doing his free inquiry stuff, it was my idea that Paul Kurtz was probably the best humanist alive that I knew, because he was reaching out to other people and saying, hey, even if you're Buddhist, even if you're whatever you are, there are things in humanism that humanism has to offer to you. And I thought, I think that's true. And so if you found humanism, not everybody gets to start where you started, and so they're looking from different viewpoints, and so he was offering this to other people.
Well, when I read this, this is already where I was.
Yeah.
And it's actually already where I was when I read Buddhism.
Right.
Without reading Buddhism.
Right, yeah.
I thought, oh, I already know this.
So it's okay for you. Could I go on to something else, or you know, I'm happy that you're happy.
And you can speak about whatever you want.
Yeah, okay, so I was looking at, we are committed to the principle of separation of church and state.
Yeah.
And it's my belief that there are a number of really viable humanist countries that do not have separation of church and state. And
well, why do you call them humanist?
Because they have humanist principles. There are, I don't know about the countries, but the people that are humanists in them are sometimes almost the majority. I'm thinking of you know, like Norway and Holland and these places. Some of these places don't have separation of church and state, and they've accommodated the idea of, well, okay, so you give funding to religious education, and so we'll file for, you know, education funds so we can have our humanist schools, you know.
Exactly.
And so,
well, that means the government isn't humanist. That means the government isn't
The government isn't humanist.
But the people may be.
The people may be
objecting to
and
that.
And so we are committed to the principle of separation of church and state. I'm saying that some governments are not committed to the separation of church and state.
Including the American one.
Right. And, you know, in words they are, but in actuality it's not.
No.
And so this is a statement that we are committed to it, but there are many humanist organizations around the world that have been able to adapt to the situation in their countries and thrive because they are also getting educational funds from the government to have their humanist schools.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's never pure.
No, it's
not
pure.
I don't think any country, I don't know, maybe I'm not right, but it seems unlikely to me that every country would be able to check every one of these things off and say
I agree with you there, but that's not important.
No, it's true.
You know, you're a human. I hope you're a humanist. Maybe
I'm a humanist.
And I am too.
Yeah.
And these are my principles, and I don't mind that no government meets them all.
Right.
It doesn't change anything.
No, but the idea of working toward these principles and having more and more of them adopted by governments and more people agree with them seems to me a worthy goal. And, you know, the Humanist Association drafted a number of principles, and you know, while Paul Kurtz was with the Humanist Association, he drafted some of them, and then when he went to his group, he drafted some more. And, you know, those are all wonderful statements.
Certainly, certainly. Well, Stephen, I just want to say that I'm a political animal, and so I'm not a singular kind of situation. So trying to, what surprised me about Bhutan, having lived in five other countries and being a political in the U.S., that these principles were applied to the most that I had ever seen in any country in Bhutan. And so I think that we only survive as a planet unless we can adopt more of these types of things, and that's what Bhutan is trying to do as an example of what you can do. Because it was Dwight D. Eisenhower in his 52 Change for Peace speech that warned against consumerism, that it would implode on itself. And that's why Bhutan in 72 saw that happening and closed down the country to control the kind of needs, as you were saying, Cy, for wants and things like that. The interesting thing is, as we're dealing with, is millennials and the difference in the young people and in Bhutan having the same thing as they're coming into the towns away from the agricultural areas and into technology. And so the impact of technology is changing agrarian to urban life. And that's always a big problem when you're trying to implement humanistic values into an urban culture is much more difficult than it is in an agrarian culture. So I'm just saying, Steve.
Really?
Yes, absolutely.
Sure. Do you think city people are less open to humanism than country people?
It's much more difficult. Yes, absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. Than an agrarian.
Like a farm life. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you're talking about America.
Well, every
country has the same thing. Mm-hmm. The farm life is simpler, you know, and it's hard work.
More
and it's
communal.
Simpler, whereas the city life is, to me, completely different.
Mm-hmm.
So
more complicated.
Yeah.
Yes, but you think humanist principles would be more acceptable to farmers than to an accountant living in the city?
I think it would be easier to like, say, implement them or learn them or tolerate them from the farm life than it would be from the city life.
Easier.
Yeah, easier. Let's say easier.
They're closer to the natural world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
Makes sense.
My experience with them is that they're very religious and parochial and
farmers?
And tribal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they have fewer needs, too.
Huh?
If I'm a farmer, my needs are simple.
Yeah.
If I'm an engineer and I need technology and I need a nice car and I need an expensive condo and I need gourmet food, and I need this, and I need... The farmer is like, are the cows doing okay? Do I have enough feed? Do I make it in?
You see the farmer in this?
Last night?
You see the farmer in this?
No.
But I don't either.
Well, yeah, I do see the farmer.
The farmer tends to be a
traditionalist. There is no, I don't think there's any hard, fast, you know...
This is the tradition.
You made a good point saying that perhaps in the agrarian society it would be easier.
Yeah.
And I agree.
Yes. Not farmers.
That's the only thing I'm agreed to.
Building the barn.
Building the barn.
Like you're talking about.
It's
okay.
Not impossible.
The barn building.
Mm-hmm. Barn raising.
You're talking about in Bhutan.
Barn raising.
Where they get together and they build the barn.
They do that in Bhutan too. They do that in Bhutan also.
Yeah. They build a barn.
Do you see that as more humanistic than not building a barn? Or I'm not sure what we're discussing.
What's the question?
The group.
I don't get it.
Cooperation.
Hmm?
I didn't get the question. What?
Well, you just talked about barn raising.
Yeah,
and rural life.
Yeah,
as being, I thought you were saying, as being representative of the values of humanism.
Sure.
Is that what
helping
you were saying?
Helping your neighbor, yeah. Sure. Helping your neighbor build a barn.
Yeah.
You haven't lived in Missouri.
Well, I
have.
Wow.
I know.
You guys break it apart and say, no, this doesn't work in, you know, Ohio.
There's no people like that in Missouri.
Okay, why not?
Right now, what I'd like to do is to go to the second part of what I had opposed, and that was about the arts.
About what?
About the arts.
Okay.
About art. Okay, and its idealism. So I did bring something, and... do any of you know Salvador Dali's painting?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, you know Salvador Dali. But do you know
big
his
museum in St. Petersburg for
I've been there.
An hour from us.
Big huge.
I've been there.
Yeah,
it's great. I'm sure you have too.
I grew up in Florida.
Okay. I did there. So I'm out of this.
We're there.
I've been from the most depraved state in the country. My husband at college said, "Do you mean deprived?" I said, "No, I mean depraved."
What state?
Florida.
Okay. So, Oklahoma's got them.
This is Salvador Dali's painting called Lincoln and Golgotha.
Called what?
Lincoln and Golgotha.
I don't understand the second two words.
Golgotha, which is where Christ was crucified.
Oh, okay.
So, tell me, they said, what you see. What do you see?
I see a sun at the top.
Well, you see the outline of Lincoln's head, first and foremost. At least I do.
You do?
When I first look at it, you can see his beard, his eyes, his hair, and the shoulders.
But you see Lincoln twice. See,
yeah.
You squint.
In the black. Look at the black and you'll see that.
If you squint, you'll see Lincoln again.
Yeah.
Okay. Squint and you'll see Lincoln again.
I see him now.
So,
yeah, I got it.
What else do you
see? I see Lincoln.
But also see a cross.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I see a cross.
Mm-hmm.
And a sun at the top, maybe.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yellow sun.
Mm-hmm. And do you see the nude woman?
I see the bottom. The butt.
The shape.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely
see
the butt.
I see that.
She's butt.
Yeah, the butt.
She's butt. Yeah, I see the butt.
Yeah. We can see the behind from here. We can't
see
the
behind.
Okay.
The back.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, it's really interesting. I've used this painting for umpteen years in lectures on.
Mm-hmm.
That I've always said that we have this old saying, and I've said it in here, the adage, that if I hadn't have seen it, I wouldn't have believed it. Where the adage really is,
if I hadn't believed it,
I wouldn't have seen it. So when I use this painting with Europeans, they immediately see Lincoln. They don't see the cross. They don't see the nude woman. And so the curious thing is just at Figueres in November, I think, in Dali's museum, I had a group, as you come in, it was an old theater. And if any of you have got your iPhones or your, none of you have your mobile phones or something?
Sure we do,
yeah.
Yeah?
Well, if you look at it through your photo taking a picture, you're going to see something very different.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I'm
going to
look out in the car.
Really?
Okay. Well, I still have a hard time.
Well, those look good. I do too, and maybe it's because it's at an angle. But
no,
no,
wait till you see.
So you're saying take a photo?
Oh my God, it's true.
Oh wow, yeah. I can
see.
Do
you see it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so wow.
Yes, I got it.
It is absolutely amazing.
Because
it becomes
less pixelated.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I don't know why that is.
Yeah, I don't see any of
it.
Yeah,
well, that is interesting that it's more visible now.
Much
less because I've been using this painting in lectures for 20-some-odd years. And it is amazing that I have to point out what Dali was saying. But when I was in Figueres, and I think it was November, December with a group, and it's at Dali's museum was an old theater, and as you come into the lobby area, this painting is up on the second balcony on a kind of a pilaster. And everybody just saw the nude woman, the cross, and whatnot. I was shocked because I put my iPad up to take a picture, and my God, everybody said, it's Lincoln. My God, it's only Lincoln. So what I'm trying to...
I saw it right away.
So what I'm saying about it is there's two realities that we Americans and whatnot tend to see that we argue over religion all the time. We're overindulgent about sex.
Yeah.
Those kinds of things jump out in the minds, I find, of Americans to quickly come up with that. Whereas the Europeans see Lincoln, and I feel that Dali saw that Lincoln was crucified, not assassinated. So that was always my theory about it. But I'm trying to tell you about when we're looking at art, there's other realities that are going on in each of your heads. as to what the painting or the art is saying. And so we have art in here that says nothing. I walked around in here and said, it says nothing, basically, except that it's a woman or something. So what I wanted to ask was, I was asking people here about Guernica, and Picasso's Guernica, and where is the idealism or the artist, those people like Picasso, Miro, who stayed in Barcelona and fought against the revolution, and those people who did try hard to bring out humanistic values and show the contradictions.
You think this shows humanistic values?
I do think that Dali is trying to very carefully, maybe not carefully, make a statement.
Well, I agree with that, but I'm not sure that it would be one that would fall into this category.
I'm just going outside, Stephen, with the human feeling of compassion, which is obviously Paul Kurtz.
Understanding,
right, exactly. These kinds of things, a kind of separation of religion.
See that here?
Yes, there's a definite cross here.
But how does that separate religion from anything else?
I'm saying he's integrating religion along with government and state and Lincoln and those possibilities.
Okay, I'm just not really understanding your point, because integrating religion with state is, to me, different from separating church and state.
Yeah, well, maybe Dali is trying to do that.
To integrate them?
To separate them.
Did you read the article recently out about the Shroud of Turin?
I've read articles about it.
Shroud of Turin has been definitively determined to be a hoax.
Yeah, 13th century.
And Leonardo da Vinci did that as a joke.
I haven't heard that it was from da Vinci, but I heard that it was much later than first century.
No, it's paint. They did a scientific analysis of the blood stains. And this is, I think it was on CNN. I forget where I pulled it off. But they have definitively said this has no religious value. It is not a shroud. It's paint.
But I'm going to ask what I've been asking over and over again. What does that have to do with the affirmations of humanism? Why are we talking about this now?
Because
I know that the Shroud of Turin is a fraud.
It's a combination of goofing on religion or making a statement through religion, through art.
Yes, absolutely, because that's what I'm trying to do, is to take these affirmations and apply them to what we live with, what we create, and that is art and science and other things. It cannot only be this kind of thing. It has to come out and be applicable to our lives and how we determine what we see, what we view, what we put on our walls as humanistic ideals and making a statement. And that's what I think that Dali was definitely making a statement here, as he did in some of his other bizarre paintings, like the clocks, watches.
So what do you think the statement is here?
I think it's the idea of our obsession with American values, which is sex, religion, and those things. I don't know, but I would say 1930s.
Okay, probably a lot of his other work. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So I just find it's very strange.
You're like Moreau.
Yeah.
Did the same. He played with religion because he also believed in everything that he believed in, and in some of his paintings played with you a little bit, because he wasn't afraid of the government.
Uh-huh.
He wasn't afraid of...
No, he wasn't.
Which artist?
Goya. Miro.
And Dali wasn't afraid of the government either.
No, he wasn't. Picasso was.
Picasso ran
to Paris.
Maybe he was.
He ran to Paris.
Even Michelangelo, the greats, had a good time with a little bit of whimsy. I mean, in the Sistine Chapel, you can see all kinds of interesting things. If you go through with a guide and he points it out and says, this is where the artist was playing a little farce or a little joke. Because the artists are well known for goofing on religion, because for the longest time that was the only people that would pay for it.
And all their benefactors were religious
people. The Medici.
Yeah, the Medici in that era, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the Medici wanted all the Madonnas and the Cupids and the God reaching out, and that's what they paid for. And, you know, these beautiful, beautiful portraits of stately men that were probably uglier than sin, but they're really handsome, and all the hags that were old and decrepit but could afford the portraits were beautiful. Yeah. They had all these flowers and everything. Exactly. They didn't dare paint reality.
Yeah, for a while. For a while.
I did want to say that there was another thing about art being used as an instrument of talking about humanistic. And the one is Goya. Yeah. And this week in the Reporter, there's a whole section that's a gallery showing in Guadalajara of his prints, his page-like prints. They were always in the bottom of the Prado, in the basement.
Oh.
They were not shown in that way. Because if you think of Goya, you think of these kinds of paintings.
Right.
But actually, the article, and I was fascinated to see that, picked up the Reporter, that there's these prints of what Goya was reacting against the Inquisition and making statements that were pretty, you know.
Close to all right,
and against even, I think that one of Goya's prints is called The Sleep of Reason Produces Monsters. Okay? And it's crystal clear critiques of superstition and the conservative religious forces that were arrayed against the Enlightenment. And so what I'm trying to say is that in our daily life, our experiences, our travels, that we open up to these humanistic values and see if the artist is making that kind of statement about these things. Because the artist is painting not only for himself, but also making a statement to the world. As Guernica, the most famous painting of Spain. So the interesting thing about Guernica is that it has no color. And I've been saying this for the last 3 or 4 years. If you notice, in design, it's all black, white, and gray. Even Bear paints put up a thing on television, black, white, and gray. Color is gone. You're wearing gray and white. And color is gone. I went to the museum, the Modern Art Museum in Barcelona, and it was all white with black lines across with hanging photos of black and white. Clothes, black, white, and gray. When color goes away, as Guernica, there is no color. It tells you that there's a sign of the lack of humanistic values and oppression, depression. The interesting thing is that color comes back with revolution, because you use color to create revolution. You don't go to war under a white flag. You go under war with aggressive nations all have red, like there's something aggressive in their flags. So what I wanted to talk about was that Picasso uses black, white, and gray to set a somber mood and express pain and chaos. Flaming buildings and crumbling walls not only express the destruction of Guernica, but reflect the destructive power of civil war. The newspaper print used in the painting reflects how Picasso learned of the massacre. The light bulb in the painting represents the sun. And the broken sword near the bottom of the painting symbolizes the defeat of the people at the hand of their tormentors. So, what Picasso is stating is that what you brought up is the tremendous suffering that life imposes. And so does it take away any humanistic?
I don't think so. We've got Banksy that works in black and white right now, and he's hot all over Europe, the United States, and he is black and white.
That's right.
Escher.
Well,
black and white.
Yeah.
Well, so the artists are saying something. They're both talking loudly, but they're talking black and white. So is that an exception to the rule, or is this a good rule, or where do you go from there?
When it flows outside the painting into the culture, that's what my contention is what I'm seeing. And in the museums, all I saw was white walls, and they ran black and white photos in the museum there and whatnot.
Yeah, but that made you feel kind of depressed. Whereas Banksy,
he loved
everybody feels rejoiced when they see it.
Yeah.
It's the same lack of colors, you know?
Uh-huh.
So it depends on who does it.
Yeah.
And when it's done.
Right. Yeah. I like those black and white old films. But,
but I do too. I like black and white photography.
Uh-huh.
It does something for me. But I guess we've got to get back to what we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, if the artist is trying to express something humanist.
Humanist, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Maybe. I think Banksy is. I don't know about Picasso, but I think Banksy is.
Well, the interesting thing about Picasso coming into Cubism and breaking up the body when Europe was breaking apart.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't make the reference. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're right about the years.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think you have to put into context other people, painters, artists, scientists, who have humanistic ideals, trying to put forth some statement, and I'm looking for those scientists for some hope. You had hope, right? Stephen said he had hope.
I have hope.
I'm lost. I'm not an artist, and so you were talking about things that I have no idea. Can I go back to the seeing Lincoln in the picture? How many saw that right off? I mean, what percentage of us see that? I did not.
I did not either.
I did not.
I saw the cross.
Yeah.
And I'm not religious at all.
And so I'm wondering, is there a difference in our perception?
Yes.
Absolutely.
She's an artist.
Okay, so artists have something.
I saw
Lincoln
immediately.
She's all Lincoln.
Dark.
I'm going to share a personal experience. I went to Italy, and I was with some other people, and they were walking by, and they were looking at, you know, advertising displays, window displays. Oh my God! And they were taking, and I looked and I said, it's an advertisement. Big deal. When we got home and I looked at their photos, all of a sudden I saw the texture, the color that had not impressed me at all. So there's some of us that are not like some of the other people, and we don't see that. And,
that's right.
And so we have to learn, I guess.
Right.
Or,
you think you're missing something?
Well, I think so.
Yes.
I'm not sure you are.
Well, I think I'm certainly missing. I'm certainly missing some knowledge and impression from this photo or this painting.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe it won't make my life any different.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And I don't think this is important.
But I think, you know, I would have enjoyed the trip more, since we spent a lot of time walking around looking at old buildings and you know, displays and photographs, and you know, that I was not interested in that kind of. I wanted to go out and hike or run around. But if I had been more perceptive, I think I would have enjoyed it better.
That's
so
right.
I'm just looking at it as a possibility. Would I enjoy life better if I had this artistic eye?
It's not that you need.
Or would I be more depressed?
You look or do you see?
It's not a question of better or worse. It's just a question of different.
Okay. Well,
you enjoyed the hike, right?
I enjoyed. Well, I didn't get to go hiking. I got to go and look at those old.
That wouldn't do much for me.
Well, it drives him crazy. I'll go, oh my God, look at that. And I'll be looking at something and I see the light and the contrast and the color. And he's like, it's a tree. Get over it. And he'll walk by.
Well, so life is here, and so what you're saying is that I might enjoy it more if I had this artistic eye.
Well, it's not necessarily that. I have lectured and taught high schoolers the Western perception of art, and based on threes. And it was always interesting with high schoolers that the boys finally, when we started into the art, we're looking for all these things, because that was my basic beginning of that life in the Western world is based on three. So then they started looking at the art, and they got interested, because that's what I wanted them to do, is to start seeing and not passing. Because looking is passing, and seeing is different. So I always felt pretty good that it was interesting. The boys are usually, but they get into a bouquet of flowers, and then they saw the triangles and the cuts and things like that.
I think it's fair to say that most humanists are male, and most of them probably are scientific and mathematical types, and so probably a critique of humanist world might be that we're not as artistic as could be.
There's a huge...
Well, I know there's a huge community of
humanists that are not scientifically oriented, that are in the humanities and arts.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, but I'm just saying, well, of course, I came from the scientific, part, and so...
But that's a fraction.
Yeah. Is it a fraction? When I was in the Humanist Association, on the board and all that kind of stuff, and we did researches and investigations, most of the members were older men, and tended to be scientific, mathematical, and professional type. Which doesn't mean they aren't artistic, but
I don't see why an artist with no interest in science couldn't say, I think.
I don't see why either. I'm just saying that might be a different perception. That's all. I'm just saying. Okay.
Okay.
Try squinting. That'll help.
What? Do what?
If you squint, you see flat, fewer details.
Are drugs apparently too supposed to
help? No, fewer details and more color and light if you squint. Look out there at that wall. People draw.
Yeah.
Yes, I don't understand that. Right. That shocked me because I had this. And I had never in 20 years, and I put it up and my God, and all of us in the group that I was talking to, the same thing. I don't know the scientific phenomenon. I don't know why the photograph, why a camera would
really? Hold when on. Your eyes are almost closed, you don't see light?
You squint, it changes it.
The lens squints.
Yeah, it's true. If you squint at it, you
another question?
See
is that okay or not?
What?
You said that Bhutan... Did I understand that Bhutan was the instigator of the movement in the United Nations and across the world of looking at happiness instead of gross national product?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So they do have every year the UN summit.
I was intrigued years ago to see this happiness quotient and the idea, and it branched out. There were many, many different efforts to do that, and I said, well, that's a better approach. Not gross national product, but gross national happiness.
Well, gross national product doesn't mean anything to you and me.
Right.
I don't care how high or low it is.
Yeah, I know, but it's something that's reported always in the newspapers and looked upon as some kind of big deal, but happiness and well-being seems like a better choice.
Yeah, because... in all my studies, 80 years, that the basis to everything seems to be put three people together is economics and drive in economics. So it was kind of nice to all of a sudden see it taken away from gross national product to gross national happiness. Because as we know, products do not produce happiness. And so, I just think of that.
So would these rules work?
Rules?
In, or whatever.
Principles.
Does it require that the people who practice them have enough to eat and a warm place to sleep at night? Because I wonder, did humanism, did that evolve with standard of living? And I can't imagine savages practicing humanism.
The hierarchy of needs.
Savages.
To me, humanism, in a sentence, is that humanity is the answer. No answers are coming anywhere from anywhere else. The animals won't provide them.
Okay.
Imaginary gods won't provide them. If life is going to get better, it's going to be because human beings figure out how to do it. That's what humanism is about.
Okay.
But on a poor level, I've always found social things that it's easier to get money out of the poor than the rich. If I'm fundraising, it's always sure. easier to get money out of the poor than the rich.
Actually, I would agree with that.
Pardon?
I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, the poor still have a little extra to give. They can afford to give a little bit, at least. The real poor, I think, you really get down to the level of savages.
Savages?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really kill or be killed for them.
I think savages maintain at the top.
I think the savages of Easter Island, before they disappeared somehow, maybe they were at a point where, as far as I know, I read, they were at a point where they were humans. They didn't have any. They didn't kill each other. You know, they had a very nice society. They weren't. They were savages, as you call them, or we call them. But they had a really cool society. What about? They weren't religious. Thank you.
They weren't religious or were?
Well, we're not sure. We're not sure because of those monoliths.
Yeah, what are those big tikis?
Now, where did those come from? You know, some people say it was religion. They were worshiping them. But I don't know.
No.
They came from outer space.
I just have a feeling that every kind of tribal group has some kind of god, you know.
Yeah. And the Aztecs, the Mayans, and before that.
Yeah. And believe me, if you're up with, as I was with the Quechua Indians at 16,000 feet, you start believing in the mountain gods.
Yeah, sure. Well, when you do that, you're leaving this. Because one of these principles up here is we're just not into supernaturalism.
Yeah, I know.
You lived in Bhutan, or you lived there for a while?
No, we had lived in Japan. We lived in Europe and other countries.
And you had been there for a while.
Yes, I did.
Off this long. Do they have a smoking problem? I mean, like Thailand, they have a smoking problem. Uh-huh. In other words, their kids, the 5 or 6 year olds, are smoking a pack of cigarettes a day.
Yeah.
And it's affecting their health, their national health. And some of the other countries in Southeast Asia have the same problem. And I was wondering, you know, Bhutan, did you see it?
No, not as much.
Well, you guys were talking about advertising before.
Yeah.
And that would hit some Marlboro hasn't come in, and Pete Orr and Philip Morris hasn't come in, and Beatty or
No, they wouldn't allow that.
You know? Okay.
But there's one sad statistic. I was at the United Nations Beijing Conference in 1995, Women's Conference, the Fourth World Conference of Women. 46,000 of us, 6,000 of us American women. That Robert Dole tried to prevent us from going.
Hey.
And the number one thing that came out, number one problem around the world, was domestic violence.
Mm.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And so, and that's still the problem everywhere, and even in Bhutan. So it's a sad thing. It's
a macho world.
It's from really ancient times, and digging up mummies in Chile in 87, that the oldest were 8,000 years old, and there was still semblances of domestic violence.
Well, maybe people were more human, you know?
Yeah.
They would get along better. No?
When they were beating each other more?
So, anyway, well, what is it, 5:30?
Yeah.
So, this.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Living in lots of countries and living in Rome, Italy, and my daughter being an international child.
Mm.
She's not a child anymore. She's in a
Roma.
So what is that? What has that done for you?
What? I'm sorry, I just missed that.
Being an international child, traveling. What has it done?
Ruined me.
Greater perspective.
It's probably, it made me very adaptable. Yeah.
And more knowledgeable,
Yeah, I wanted. Yeah, I wanted only two things for my children, three daughters, and that was to have compassion and survival skills. And I think that's all you need. So all three of them can pick up a backpack and go anywhere in the world and manage. Except, okay, I'm in my 80s, and there's this problem of role reversal. And Leslie has lived here close by for 13 years, so she knows. But your children start thinking you can't do anything for yourself. I went to Barcelona, and Leslie came, and my oldest daughter came. And we moved around the world, and I had three children and had to learn languages fast, especially in Japan when in 1970 there was no semblance of English anywhere. And so my daughter Tracy said, Mom, this is the metro now. Do you know how to use the metro? Mom, okay, do you know where your apartment is?
Is the metro the subway?
Yeah, in Barcelona.
I think they call it that in Paris, too.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we had lived in Paris. Of course I know how to use the thing. So anyway, she was so worried that it's not going to be able to survive.
Oh, for Paris.
But I did well for...
Yeah. Well, thank you, Valerie. That's very nice.
Yeah, well, you're welcome. But I do want to say to you, if you've ever been seeing in St. Peter's in the Vatican, okay, now I do tour that. I studied with Peter Rockwell, Norman's son, for years. And so I learned a lot of things, especially about Norman. But going up to the Baldacchino, the main altar, okay, it's Bernini. There's bas-reliefs on the bottom. And as you look to the left, you're going to see at the bottom of the column, which came from the Pantheon, is a woman's face, and then a shield comes out like this. And at the bottom, kind of like genitalia. But then if you move around and go around the Baldacchino to the left, you'll see her, and you'll see her face start to change. And as you come all the way around and to the right side, you see her screaming. And then as you come in front of the Baldacchino on the right-hand side, her face is gone, and there's a baby's face, and the shield is flat.
Oh,
jeez. Wow.
So the Jesuits were really upset because it was much more graphic than that, and the Jesuits,
I had no idea.
Yeah, were much more Puritan.
Yeah.
And so, so I just want you to say that there's a lot to see that you missed.
I missed a lot of things.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.